Welcome to Lena Live, hosted by Professor Lena Miermond, and I'm producer Julian Lampert. Today we present part two of our series devoted to Calvary Hospital, one of the supporters of our program. We feature Dr. Michael Brescia, the executive medical director of the institution, who will be speaking about Calvary as well as his own personal work. Dr. Brescia is a pioneer of medicine in his own right, and we will hear about that later in the program. We begin our dialogue with Dr. Brescia with the question of what makes Calvary unique in its treatment of the terminally ill. Let's listen to Dr. Brescia speak.
Emotional suffering is the thing that defines Calvary the best, how we handle emotional suffering. And emotional suffering is this total feeling who you are and what you are, it's the sucking out of love. And there is no, there's the absence of love. It's abandonment at its premiere. Let me explain again what the absence of love. I'll be more specific why this is what defines Calvary here. You would think it would be the spiritual. The spiritual is useless, but us trying to, by how we behave, make you come to know that there is somebody that loves you and cares for you. But the emotional suffering is the total feeling of abandonment. It is the absence of love. It's the final farewells. This is it. You're going to say goodbye, and you're not going to, and I can tell you, that is agony. The final farewells. And that's what terrifies and taunts people dreadfully. The absence of love. And if there's the absence of love, and this is the core of Calvary, this is what I've seen and believe, is to return the love. And how do you return love? Any of us. You love your mother loves her son. I love Barbara, Barbara loves me. I'm just saying, using that as an analogy, but to return to love. How do we return love to our patients? And this is the difference in Calvary. To love our patients, we have to be present. One way or the other, we have to make our presence felt. You can't say, I'm going to lunch when I come back, I'll come to see you, and don't go. That is devastating. If you're not going to go, don't go. That seems simple. To love someone in that situation, you have to be present. There's a calming, just the fact that you're present. The second part of to love someone is to touch. We have to touch. You have to touch. Much like a child, you have to touch. The third part of loving someone is to hold them. And if you see what you're really doing, many of the ancient psychiatrists, even the 1800s psychiatrists, tried to behave as a parent, as a mother, back to the patients. Freud did too. And he wasn't far off. The third way is to hold someone. It's to hold them. And the final way you love is to say it. Don't say you think you know it. They know. My wife knows. She knows. He knows that. No one knows anything at that time. They only know what you say. And the final act is you have to say with your arms around them, I love you. Mama, I love you. And hold them. So you have to be present. You have to touch. You have to hold. And then the greatest gift is you have to say it. You have to speak. That's how you love.
It's extraordinary to listen to a physician speak like a profoundly spiritual being, almost making one forget that we're listening to a physician. Joining us today is Dr. Michael Brescia, the Executive Medical Director of Calvary Hospital, one of the supporters of our program. Let's pause for a message from Calvary Hospital.
Dear Calvary Hospital, James Lee was a true hero. Saving lives was something he always wanted to do. Whether as a paratrooper for the 82nd Airborne or as a New York City fireman, they called him Jimmy. I was proud to call him Dad. But when terminal illness ravaged his body, this man's man knew that this was one life that could not be saved. Not even by me, an experienced nurse. It just wasn't fair that he had to suffer like this. But then Calvary stepped in. You relieved his enormous pain and not only gave him the peace and comfort he deserved, but you also gave me and my family a chance to enjoy his final days, smiling and laughing, together one last time. How can we ever forget what you mean to us? Yours truly, Colleen Lee.
This is Frank Calamari, president of Calvary Hospital, where life continues. Call us at 718-518-2000. Thank you.
Welcome back to Lena Live. I'm producer Julian Lampert. We're listening to Dr. Michael Brescia, the executive medical director of Calvary Hospital. Dr. Brescia sounds more like a philosopher, like a spiritual being of a universal kind when he speaks. And this is very profound, considering that he is a physician directing our country's premier institution for palliative care. Let's listen to Dr. Brescia talk about how the families are treated by Calvary.
Families suffer exactly like the patients suffer. And they need the same, we're talking about the families, the thing that you give to the patient, you need to give to the family. They need a presence. And I would put hyphen, information. Families need information and comfort. So you have to be a presence to them. You have to hold their hands. You have to hold them, and you have to speak to them. And reassure them that your mother, your child, is a gift to me. I thank you for giving me this gift of taking care of. Please don't let me fail you. Let me measure up to what it is you hope I could be. If I could give you back their life, I would. I can't. But I could give you everything else. But I can't give you the life. So family is huge energy. About 90% of the energy a doctor spends and expends here is on the family. They're a difficult patient. They need the most. They need the time. And that's what the letters we get don't come from patients. They come from the family. And when we fail, it comes from the family. And last, the worst form of suffering is grief. You see, the other types, they have a time limit to a certain degree, maybe not perfect, but grief. Mr. Grief, he don't go away.
We're listening to Dr. Michael Brescia on the Lena Live Radio Hour. He is the Executive Medical Director of Calvary Hospital. And you're listening to part two of our series devoted to Calvary, one of the supporters of our program. Let's listen to Dr. Brescia talk about his own personal work in the field of nephrology. That's the field of medicine that deals with the kidneys. Dr. Brescia and his colleague, Dr. James Cimino, made a revolution in this area in 1966 by inventing the device which enabled patients to undergo kidney dialysis. And with this invention, they saved hundreds and thousands of lives. Let's listen to Dr. Brescia speak about this.
I think it was really, in a way, fortuitous. My background in medicine has always been on organ transplantation and nephrology. I was considered a kidney specialist, but really with an aim towards being able to take someone with no kidneys and put in a kidney from another person and have it work. And where this came from was that in the Vietnam War, many of these young soldiers coming back had no kidney function. Of course, they were doomed at that point to die. You last about 2 to 3 weeks, depending on what the situation, the comorbidities are, but 2 to 3 weeks, and then you die. The whole concept then was to be able to use an artificial kidney, construct an artificial kidney that would prolong the life until a proper match for a transplanted planted kidney would be available. And there was very little work being done on that. However, the Veterans Administration taking these young people coming back from Vietnam was working feverishly on some methodology. Also, for non-military people, if your kidneys failed and there was going to be any hope of you surviving, but you would have to go on dialysis, which is the process of cleansing the blood several times a week. And after the blood was cleansed, you'd have to come back the next week. The big problem was, in order to do the cleansing, you needed a blood flow from the person to this artificial kidney of about 300 cc's a minute, which would be a large amount of blood. It would be a pint, almost, of blood that would have to go back. So it would come from the person into this cleansing apparatus, which was not a problem. The cleansing apparatus was not a problem, and then returned in another portion of the body. I'm like, keep doing this. The cleansed blood would then return to the various organs, pick up the poisons, recirculate, go back in the kidney, and come back. So it was a constant change, exchange. And I think you could, you'd be able to imagine that. The problem was, and you can appreciate this, almost everyone could, how do you get 300 cc's a minute from this person? You could do it once, you could do it twice, because you'd have to use an artery in the wrist, an artery in the groin, about 3 or 4 times. But after that, there was no safe methodology being able to come back week after week after week. And subsequently, the complications from attempting to do that fail. The patient could not go on the kidney because there was no other ways to do the dialysis, and they died. The huge energy put, and this is a while ago, we're talking about 30 years ago, 40 years ago, the big energy in all the major centers, which we now take for granted, was what methodology could there be where I could take Julian, take 300 cc's a minute, put it through this dialyzer, this cleaning machine, which really doesn't matter too much, and return it in another arm. And we do it, you'd feel better after that treatment, go home, but since you do not put out any urine, the symptoms would return. And the symptoms were horrible. Horrible. Renal death was not a nice way. And so all over the world, there was an intense energy as how are we being able to do this? The methodology that was in place resulted in explosions at the site where they put these tubes. Infection was horrendous, and clotting. So these three major problems almost prevented success in repeated dialysis. All the world was working on a method to be able to successfully be able to recirculate the blood 3 times a week until the kidney was found. Now, we were talking about 3 months, 4 months. It was awful that, you mean in 4 months, maybe there'd be a match possible? Maybe my son was 18, 19 years old, or my dad or my mom would be able to survive this. But there was no methodology in place. One day, me and my partner were working on this. It was very frustrating. And we had 12 people, I remember exactly, waiting to go on the artificial kidney machine, and we had no real method available. And they'd be sitting in a waiting room with their little children playing around them, parents, involved people, pleading eyes to help, and there was no methodology. On this particular day, of course, we did all kinds of fairy tale stories trying to help because we didn't want to go up and say, by the way, there is nothing. Mm-hmm. And I ordered a hamburger. And it, you have to believe in Providence sometimes. And the waitress said, do you want French fried potatoes with it? And I said, yeah, yes. And we were sitting there talking to each other like I was talking to you now, and put the French fries on the table next to me, and I certainly show. I put the two French fries here, one next to the other. I bit into this hamburger, which was laden with ketchup. A piece of ketchup fell and landed on one French fry and the other French fry. And so now what we had effectively was an H, with the crossbar being a wad of ketchup. And I said at that time, maybe if we could make a fistula, which would mean that the blood would come down the artery, when it reached this here abnormal connection, the blood would zip around and go back up the vein. So this would be the artery here, and this would be the vein. Putting it up together, making a hole between them, using a microscope to make the hole, we would have created the abnormal connection of an artery and vein, which is called a fistula. We said, well, let's try this. The first 12 failed. But by failed, it meant that we did the fistula, and then within a few hours, it clotted. That connection broke down. And we were tormenting, why did this break down? And we found out the reason that it broke down was because we had prepared the patient so well that they did not have any more hypertension. Their all the other factors involved in the comorbidities, the other diseases they had was treated. We wanted them in the best pre-surgical condition. And that was wrong. Because really what we needed was the patient to have high blood pressure. So that when the blood came down the artery, the pressure was so high that it squirted across the barrier into the vein easily. So a few patients were desperate, and we didn't do it. And we're down there, and I'm saying, these two are working. These people are in very bad shape. We were able to bring them upstairs and put them on the artificial kidney machine. Successfully. And soon we had almost a 95% success rate. So this meant that when they came in, we put a needle here and a needle here, and we took the blood from the artery, put it through the circulator, came back in and went in the vein. If you could picture that.
Yes.
And we had what was called an arteriovenous fistula, which became actually the savior for millions of people. Because after that, all the complications that occurred with tubing, et cetera, were gone. The big thing was when they used these tubes to stick out of the skin, they became infected. And consequently, it became a huge, huge problem. It did last a day or two. Next thing, this patient had fever and chills because this tube coming out. Now, with the fistula, which was under the skin, the trick was the connection had to be under the skin with no outside aperture.
Yes. Yeah.
And we could then take this arm with this fistula and put it in a cesspool and take it out, and there'd be no infection. Because now there was a huge blood supply to the hand and there was no infection. And this was a major success. So that's what I was doing. I was on the way to the University of Pennsylvania for a nice cushy academic position while volunteering, and it seemed like everything had to be together, while volunteering at Calvary with my colleague, Dr. Cimino. And we got calls from all over because people were desperate. They were just dying. I mean, when you can imagine, you got three or four dialyses and then no more. With the fistula, you could go for months and months. And the idea was to find the proper tissue match so that you could take this kidney from a cadaver quickly after they died, put it in, and have this transplant. And there's millions of them now. And that was the which still bears our name, Professor Cimino arteriovenous fistula, which is used all over for dialysis. We were waiting for a pharmaceutical company, Baxter Lab, who had invested their time and a lot of their resources and asked us, don't publish it because we want to set up centers around the world using the fistula. And they showed us all these out. You can imagine the PR. Mm-hmm. Pictures of people near dead in one picture, and the next one, the guy's up there playing squash. So, I mean, they said, and we need that. And so I, and this is my favorite part, I went to see my, and they said, and the estimate for this would have been about $900 million. Not a bad income, even if I got half of that there. And I went and told my father, and my father said to me, I'm so proud of you. I can't believe that you did this here. Which is, well, when are the people going to get it? Hurry up. And I said, well, we're going to hold it back about a year, until all the centers, and they're going to have a big explosive worldwide PR event on the use of this with movies and people, etc. And my father said, how many will die then in that year? I said, in the U.S., about 50,000. He said, no good. He said, no good. And then he told me in Italian, when you shave in the morning, your face will disappear in the face of the mothers and fathers that should be with their families, will appear to you one after the other. But they'll be dead because you know you need five boats and you need five houses. And all this is in Italian. I see this stuff coming out. I was getting very uncomfortable. And he says, and tutti I ragazzi non combattere più, which means, and the children, no longer will they be there with their parents. I mean, look at your children, and they'll be taken one after the other. And you will have, they'll be gone. You know why this is going to happen, son? Because tu bisogno tutti li modi di questo mondo. No. Lasciarli. I'll never forget that word. Lasciarli. He says, this is because you need five houses, five boats, five cars, five this, five that. Let it go. Publish it. Let it go. And then I started yelling at him. I said to him, that's why non c'è per mangiare. Non c'è per pranzare. And that's why we didn't have what to eat. We couldn't even sit down and have a big dinner because of the poverty during this time there. And we didn't have, and that's why, Dad, because you always had your mind someplace else, not down here. La Charlie. That's it. Give it away. So when I left the house that day, I knew I was doomed because I wasn't going to go against that. And we published it. And of course, all the poor people came, you know. It's true. I just came across something here just the other day. Maybe it was meant to be on message. What happened is that Greta Garbo came, because these people were hanging on, waiting for the chance to lift. So Greta Garbo, Fernando Marcos, Liberace.
Really?
Yep. Yes, Liberace. He was in a car accident. He was shot kidney. And he was dying of kidney, if he was going to die, and he got the transplant. He went on dialysis. He got the fish. He went on it. And on and on and on. And after that, every time I was volunteering at Calvary Hospital, and Calvary Hospital was about to be closed because we didn't have the money to continue to care for and fulfill the regulations. And so that was going to happen. The government was going to close us because there's a lot of rules in a hospital. You can just only imagine the rules. I'm about to close. And that's why I say things maybe come together because you don't know. The inspector was coming to check Calvary Hospital, so the old one in the Bronx, to close it. When the inspector came, I'm walking down the hallway with him, and he says, I'm a kidney specialist, and you know you have a very famous name in dialysis. He is in the University of Pennsylvania now developing transplant programs. His name was Dr. Kruger, and I said, no, I'm him. He said, no, you're not him. He's in the University of Pennsylvania. I said, no, sir, I promise you it's me. So we spent... It was like that's the way it was supposed to be. And we spent 4 hours going over. He had a million questions on kidneys and all this stuff, the dialyzers, of which nobody knew more. And I'm not trying to tout myself, but yeah. We were right at the forefront. We did it. I mean, so what happened was this guy said, you know what? I got a call that night from Dr. Kruger. He was staying at the Waldorf. I'll never forget it. And he said, you know, he said, all the talking there, I never filled out the papers to get you approved. I said, I'll be down tonight. And down to the Waldorf we went, filled out the papers, and he says, I'll swear this stuff exists. He said, but I'm going to give you a temporary approval as a hospital for a year. And so now we could charge for the care of the patients at Calvary, whereas before, without Medicaid or Medicare, we couldn't get any funding, and Calvary was on the verge of closing. So together, the people got their organs, and that was off, because now it exploded the field. Now they had a way. And they exploded the field, and we started collecting money from the federal government to care for these patients. And thus, we were now no longer a hospice, we were now a hospital for the treatment of advanced cancer. So that's how I wound up here. And every time I was going to leave, the cardinal would call me and say, could you stay till we really get this going? And before you knew it, I was locked in. I just couldn't leave anymore. And there were a lot of people doing the dialysis. They didn't need me anymore. The big thing was the fistula, which to this day, if you Google it, you know, Brescia's, Cimino, arterial venous fistula, it's still the way to go on the artificial kidney machine. And places, and the other thing that made it so wonderful was places that could not ever afford this. The procedure had no cost, nothing. Some talented surgeon could go ahead there and do the procedure, and it was for free. Anybody could do it. They needed thread, they needed the suture, and they needed a small bit of training, so all over the world. And not only that, they didn't have to keep going back for infection and drugs and all that. The fistula removed all of that. So it was an amazing, I was just, not knowing I was gonna meet you, I was just looking at some of the letters I got from around the world. And I got one now from a little town in Romania. And it's over there saying, you don't even know what you did. You saved my wife and my family. So I read that. I said to myself, you're probably right. Maybe I didn't know. And that's where I morphed into what it is that I do now, or think I'm doing now. That's how we went from this premier position. Whenever I go on a trip and talk, people don't want to hear about palliative care, death and dying. They want to hear about the fiscal. And now it's about 1,500 articles a month published on the fistula. And it lasts for years until the proper match is available, whereas before you were rushing, hoping, praying, and these people died. They lost it. So that's how I'm here.
did your father live to see?
Yes.
Extraordinary he did. Success.
He did. He was extraordinarily proud and pleased with that. And I made sure he knew how much he was part of this decision, and maybe probably the premier part, because being human and selfish, I had six children. I could only see how much wealth would come, how I could get a bigger house instead of living in the Bronx someplace over here on 233rd Street. I had a 1951 Ford Victoria used car. I couldn't get a nice big station wagon. I saw all the things that humans see. And I don't want to make believe I'm a saint, but it was really my father who read me the Riot Act. And and here I am now. And I think that God in his own way had a plan, because if I wasn't who I was at that time, and the inspector wasn't who he was at that time, would have this all happened? I don't think so.
It's incredible that your work as a pioneer in nephrology crisscrossed with the fate of this hospital. That's incredible.
Who could have
predicted
that?
So you saved... Yes. Really, single-handedly, you saved this institution.
Yes.
It's incredible.
We're listening to Dr. Michael Brescia, the Executive Medical Director of Calvary Hospital, one of the supporters of our program. Let's take a brief pause for a message from Calvary.
Dear Calvary Hospital, my dad was at the end of his life, suffering from pancreatic cancer. I knew there was only one place that could relieve his pain and ours as well, Calvary Hospital. His wish was to die at home, so it was Calvary Home Hospice that provided Dad with the quality of life he deserved, filled with exceptional comfort and warmth. He passed on with dignity and grace, and we were all there with him. A year later, my mom needed the same Calvary care. And once again, Calvary's expert home hospice staff was there for us. My parents gave me unqualified love their entire lives. There was no better way for me to return this love than with Calvary's care. Yours truly, Deborah DiGregorio.
This is Frank Calamari, president of Calvary Hospital. Our world-renowned hospice program brings our expert end-of-life care right into your home. Call us at 718-518-2465.
We're back with Lena Live. I'm Julian Lampert, and we're listening to part two of our series devoted to Calvary Hospital. Our guest today is Dr. Michael Brescia, the Executive Medical Director of the hospital. Let's listen to Dr. Brescia talk a little bit about the beginnings of Calvary.
Calvary, when it began, early on, it was initiated as the House of Calvary in Manhattan. So we began in the 1898 opened up in Manhattan. And so it was just a house of Calvary. Really what it was a place where people had advanced cancer. They didn't know what to do with them. This group of women said, we'll care for them. And they gave comfort care, washing, cleaning. But there was no high technical kind of skills involved. But we were in Manhattan and stayed there a long time. We always had a dream of, we lost them. For example, the price of the buildings went up. Perry Street now, about $9 million for a Worcester Street. And so we had four patients in Perry Street, another four on Worcester Street. The property was sold because it became valuable in Greenwich Village. And the Archdiocese of New York wanted to save the Calvary experience and had 110 beds at an old school in the South Bronx. But the dream was always to get back to Calvary in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. And and I'll give you another mundane reason. All the wealth and fundraising capabilities for which we needed was in Manhattan. So a nursing home, there was a couple of nursing homes opened in Manhattan, but we always lost money because the care we gave, we did not sacrifice anything for our patients. And we thought that if we could get some beds in Manhattan again, we would have better PR opportunities and more opportunities to raise money to save the mission. And what happened is that now, finally, Mary Manning Walsh, which was a nursing home in a prestigious area, Catholic, said, we'll give you 10 beds to open not a Calvary hospital, but a lower level of care, not where the medical intensity of services would not be as great, but nevertheless important. And so Mary Manning Walsh leased us 10 beds. We got permission. And so now we'll have 10 beds to care for those patients in Manhattan who have cancer mainly, need an intense level of services, but not quite hospital, but just below hospital. And we finally got that and we're building it now. And it's going to be an opportunity for fundraising. We did get some wonderful donors that are helping us, but we're going to need more, because you don't make money on our patients. You lose money. For us to make money, we would have to compromise the quality of care. We're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. Then I'd rather shut the door and go away. If I'm going to say, well, you know what? This patient really could use this medicine, but it costs too much, so I'm not going to give it. No, I can't do that. What made this, for example, in the 40s, I'm going to take you back to Germany, in Auschwitz, or was it Bergen-Belsen? A poor Jewish man witnessed guards, when things were boring, would take a prisoner, put the razor barbed wire maybe 12 inches long, and have a pole in the middle with notches. And they let him stand there in the rain and the freezing, etc. And the guards would take bets on when he would fall and when he fell on what notch, and cut his throat with the razor barbed wire. We're not there. These horror, you know, the worst thing you could have been was born a twin in Nazi Germany during that time, because they would take the arms off her. She got twins. Cut the arms off one, and then cut the arms off the other, and switch the arms. Most of them became worthless, horrendous experiments beyond any demon we could. I mean, these are demons. This is evil beyond evil. It is, if there is a devil entity ever, if you're ever going to believe in a devil, and I'm not suggesting you do at all, but if you were, those that took the arms off, they were demons. They had to be something different. At any rate, the things they comprised and made up in these camps were beyond imagination. So that's a scene with this here. Mm. We come here, and it was part of the program we put together here, separate us, is Mr. Bogdan. He falls on the floor. I get called upstairs. They tell me that he fell down, and maybe we should put a posy. A posy is a little loose belt like this, a little fatter. And it flops over the side and goes to the mattress so that he could move and get up to a certain degree. But he was restrained because we were afraid he'd get out of the bed and break a bone. And we were horrified at that. So we put the posy. Mr. Bodkin was in one of the camps, Bergen-Belsen, I believe it was now. It's coming to me. Where this amusement was being done. And he relates this to me and says to me, let me fall on the floor and die and break whatever bones I want, but don't restrain me, ever. Now when you think of it, it's like, how can we restrain? So I walk out of his room. I go about 12 feet, and I stop. I turn around. I walk back into his room, Mr. Bodkin. I roll up his sleeve. I kiss his tattoo. And I said, no one will ever be restrained again at Calvary. Never. Under no circumstance. And so, the reason I'm getting to this story is that no one is ever tied here. The only restraints are arms of love, hugging them. And almost in all cases, within a few days of hugging and careful, you don't need any more restraints of any kind. But in the interim, we build special rooms of glass so that one person could watch them. And they are never restrained. That costs money because you need a person every shift, three shifts. Yeah. But I don't care. I'd rather spend $1.2 million a year so that no one is restrained ever again. And so we are totally restraint free. No one. Mm. And that's what we call the Bodkin rule. And no one is ever restrained. And this is where the money came from. So then we would have to go back, okay, let's save $1 million. Let's restrain them. No. We don't restrain. If this person represents a sacred individual in your life, you don't restrain him.
Yeah.
And so that's where the money went. So now, Mary Manning Walsh, back to Mary Manning Walsh. There'll be no restraints. We'll lose money on the inpatient, but we believe that we will make money, and I don't want to sound venal. We will get donations based on love to help us so that no one is ever restrained. Because if they're going to be restrained, I wouldn't work there. There'd be no Calvary. That's not us. You don't restrain anybody. Did you see the compats here in the lobby?
I did, yes.
Okay, if you see there,
the guns, the beautiful.
Those are us, nobody's restrained. We all got our arms around them. And you know what? Within a day or two, after they've been treated well, many times they're carrying on because their bladder is filled with urine. Can you imagine? They can't urinate. the bladder ruptures. So one of the first things we'll do on many of these people is they either obstructed from feces or their bladder. Their bladder is full and they have to evacuate. Mm. So that's going to be the Walls Project. The Catholic Church gave us the 10 beds to go back to Manhattan. We're going back, and the purpose is be able to give home care and be able to have the opportunity to fundraise, because we lose, I'm not ashamed to say it, we need the money, and we lose $8 to $10 million a year. We lose because of no restraints. The restraints alone are $1 point something million. Open diets. There's no, for example, the Orthodox community. We spent a fortune on the Shabbos suite upstairs. We have special kitchen, special, so everything is upstairs. I don't know whether you saw that or not, but we have a large Orthodox community.
I'm aware of it because my father was here.
Okay. Well, now it's beautiful.
I see.
They helped us. We raised the money, and there's a beautiful Shabbos suite upstairs, both for sleeping and eating, and their families are just thrilled with that ability. We fulfill, we're very well connected with the Orthodox community, very close to them. Which, as we say, we wouldn't be here if you weren't here.
Yes.
We stand on your shoulders to be who we are. So that's the, and now we're back, we're building now. We'll be back in Manhattan again and hopefully be able to successfully raise. And I think we will. I think we will do very well.
For a potential donor interested in making a contribution to Calvary, what would be the best way in which to do that?
We would call the Calvary Fund and offer that you were interested in making a donation to Calvary Hospital, and believe me, after that, they'll give you all the information, et cetera, et cetera, for that. And I was walking with a man the other day. He was walking his dog, I was walking my pup. He asked me about Calvary. I told him about Calvary. 2 days later, I got $2,000. He sent me $2,500. I sent it downstairs.
Okay.
Thanked him, I sent him a beautiful letter. Thanking him for that, but there's no intermediary. That goes straight into the function of the hospital.
Yes.
There is no place, and that makes all these other features that, you know, would not be, couldn't be. It has this ability to not make you care of the process that's happening. And it's a very potent antidepressant. Because only 12% of people get depressed. You have a 30-pound tumor growing on your chest, and you're not depressed? How could this be?
Yeah.
Narcotics are powerful antidepressants. And we have, a lot of times people don't understand why that's true, but it's true. Calvary's entire program is built around what I just told you. We have a large pastoral department for those who feel good reading something and they feel better, and pastoral people that attend to them and see them, ritualism, memorialization, all of that, they do it. The mental aspects, we have a large psychiatric component, we have a full-time psychiatrist here that isn't bad, was working with, he himself has had personal tragedies, and he's working with the families, the patients, and the doctors, and the staff, and everybody else that need that. Emotional suffering is the key to Calvary. You have to love your patients. Sympathy is not enough. Empathy is not enough. It has to be love. If it's not love, it's not going to work. Nothing's going to work. So we have emotional suffering, we have physical suffering, and that depends on a talented, tremendous a physician who are well-trained and understand what they have to do with the physical problems. They're science, that's the science. What I gave you before is not. This is the science of that, and you need good doctors that are able to do this here. Use the medicine to the fullness of their capacity. Families, energy, a lot of energy. A lot of time, and you have to open yourself up.
You have to open yourself up to that.
We are honored to have Calvary Hospital of New York City as our sponsor. Calvary, it's where life continues. We listen to a man who approaches medicine from not only the scientific viewpoint, but from a profoundly human and soulful place within himself. Dr. Michael Brescia, the Executive Medical Director of Calvary Hospital, among the supporters of our program. Thank you for joining us. And next time, part 3 of our series devoted to Calvary. Until then, have a wonderful week. And see you next time.